Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, joined by somebody that I've been hunting down for quite some time now, and a name that most people will know is Dr. Jim Dawley. And you will know him better as the White Coat Investor, and likely is definitely one of the most influential financial sites for emergency medicine and medicine as physicians in general. And Jim's done a fantastic job, and interesting learning about him earlier this year, finding out that this was not a born interest for him, being the financial side of things, but more of a completely emergency medicine style approach to things, finding a need, getting tired of having challenges, and thus deciding to take it into his own hands, and really has turned it into an incredible resource for emergency physicians and physicians in general, as well as other folks within the healthcare realm. Presence online at thewhitecoatinvestor.com. And Jim, tell us a little bit about yourself. I kind of teased the story a little bit because clearly medicine is not known for producing great financial minds. And, you know, you're here as a resource that we can all use. So tell us a little bit more about how it came to be and what you're seeing in terms of the challenges facing finances and physicians.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that's a broad range of questions you just gave me there. I think I can talk for about 3 hours just answering the ones you just gave me right there, but I'll keep it short.
Perfect. Perfect.
You're absolutely right that physicians have a reputation as being terrible with money. And honestly, it's probably well deserved. We really don't do a great job with money. And there's a few reasons for that. Number one is probably the fact that we get no training in it whatsoever. As undergraduates, we're really focused on pre-med stuff and getting into med school. There's little room in medical school for any training on business or personal finance or investing. We tend not to get it in residency, again, because we're very busy. And then we move into a busy career. And so we never get the training. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that we're actively discouraged from talking about money and business. It's almost a taboo subject among people in general, and particularly in the halls of our medical institutions. The larger and the more academically focused your institution, the more taboo it seems to be. And so we don't talk to each other, and we don't teach our trainees about money and how to handle it and about the business of medicine. So gradually, as the world has become more financially complex, we've been left behind. Then the third factor is we're actively targeted by the financial services industry, many of whom view us as whales to be harpooned due to our relatively high incomes. And so there's actually a nefarious force out there trying to keep us from becoming smart and doing smart things with our money that we have to actually actively work against to avoid those problems. But those, I think, are the reasons why docs are so bad with money.
We've talked about it a little bit. How much of a challenge is it, this life where we've gone for 25 to 30 years with being basically relatively in the poorhouse, spending much more than we bring in, if you bring in anything, to, you know, being in the top 5 to 10% of earners in any given community? How does that transition from to want to relative excess, how does that play into the mistakes that we make and some of the challenges we face as physicians getting into our careers as an attending?
Oh, it's absolutely huge. Part of the difficulty is the world at large, and physicians in particular, have difficulty distinguishing between the two concepts of wealth and income. It's entirely possible to be very wealthy with a very low income, and to be very poor or unwealthy, whatever you want to call it, with a high income. And that's the typical situation for a new attending. A new attending has this income that puts them in the top 1 or 2 or 5% of Americans, which, you know, if you look worldwide, is an even higher percentage. But yet they have a net worth that puts them among the poorest people on the planet. It's not unusual at all for a physician to leave residency owing $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 in student loans. So their net worth is literally minus $300,000. They're poorer than the guy living under the aqueduct down the street in terms of their net worth. And so I think that has a huge effect. I mean, the first focus for most physicians, at least financially coming out of residency, should be getting back to broke. you know, getting back to a net worth of zero. And I think that's a focus and a mindset that you have to pick up if you want to be successful building wealth.
How do we, talking with Dr. James Dolly here, with author of The White Coat Investor and the creator of the whitecoatinvestor.com, how do we, you mentioned that we'd start off, you know, you talk about getting back to zero as your first goal. But then as soon as we get into it, we are already 10 years, a decade plus behind our contemporaries with our retirement, our savings. And as we know with money, the earlier you get it, the you're into it and investing it and saving it, the more than faster that it builds and the more $1 means at retirement than it does if you start at 30, 35. What challenges do we face with that, with emergency physicians and physicians in general? I keep saying emergency physicians. We're both emergency physicians, but I mean physicians in general, in terms of making that step, in terms of savings, and trying to catch up with folks that have been already been working and saving for 10 years.
I mean, I think we do have a couple of disadvantages. Number one, we start out in a big hole. You know, I mean, a few of us have been fortunate enough that our parents were able to really help with the cost of our schooling, or perhaps we were able to get a nice contract with the military or whoever else to kind of pay for our medical school. But for most of us, we start out in a huge hole. So that's disadvantage number one. Disadvantage number two is we start out so late. Most of us aren't out of residency until sometime between 30 and 35. And so that is, you know, a late start. If we were, you know, liken this to a running race, let's say we're doing a 400 meter race, you know, it's like we're not only starting late, but we have to run further than 400 meters while the rest of the runners just have to run 400 meters. However, we also have a huge advantage. It's not like that decade was completely wasted. We came out of that decade of training with a very nice financial pearl that a lot of other people in America would love to have, and that's our high income. Basically, although we're starting late and we're starting out behind, we run faster than the other runners do. And so if we just don't waste that speed of ours, our high income, we can not only catch up, but we can surpass them just by being smart with money. And so that's what I've tried to do over the years with the White Coat Investor, is teach people how to be smart with their money. In a lot of ways, by virtue of your high income, you're a little bit like, I think it was the Seahawks a few years ago in the Super Bowl, right? They're on like the 3-yard line, and all they had to do was run the ball into the end zone, they win the Super Bowl. But they decided to get fancy and try to do some sort of a throwing play instead of just pounding it up the middle. And that's like physicians, right? All we got to do, we've already done 90% of the work. All we got to do is run the ball into the end zone. But too many times we try to get fancy and we screw it up. And despite our high income, we still end up not building any sort of wealth. If you look at the statistics, it's actually pretty amazing. If you just ask doctors, what's your net worth? Everything you own minus everything you owe. And you go to doctors at the end of their career, people in their 60s, you'll find out that about 12% of them have a net worth of under $500,000. After 30 years of physician paychecks, they got less than $500,000 left. And I think that's terrible. In fact, about 25% total have less than $1 million. They're not millionaires. After being paid, you know, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 for 30 years, they got less than $1 million of it left. And that's just really a reflection of not enough financial discipline, not enough financial literacy. And so those are the two qualities I'm trying to instill in people. So they can get that financial success that they deserve, because medicine and emergency medicine in particular are not easy ways to make money. There are far easier ways to make money out there. And I think it's certainly, if you're going to put in the sort of effort that it requires to be a good emergency physician, you ought to be rewarded financially for doing so.
You started rolling into it there. Relatively poor decisions that physicians make, and you being in this as long as you have, I'm sure you've heard and seen plenty of stories and may have participated in some of those, you know, thoughts and mistakes yourself. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you see physicians making that will impact them long currently and long term when it comes to finances?
I think if you start right at the beginning, right, start in medical school. Now, there are decisions there that have an impact on your financial well-being, such as how much debt you take out as a medical student. You know, it's pretty amazing. You see two different medical students, both of whom are paying for their schooling with loans, who end up with significant differences in how much they borrow, just depending on how they choose to live during medical school. Also, the choice of your specialty will have a pretty significant effect on both your lifestyle and your income and your ability to build wealth throughout your career. And so the decisions, even at the beginning, have a big effect. But I think the ones that entrap most physicians are they don't get focused on saving right away in their careers. And so what I try to tell them to do is to live like a resident for the first few years out of residency. Basically, keep living like they were only making $50,000 a year as a resident and live on that and take the difference between that and their attending physician income and use that difference to build wealth, to pay off their student loans, to save up a down payment on their dream house, to catch up to their college roommates with their retirement savings. And basically, for a period of 2 to 5 years after residency, just really focus financially on becoming wealthy. You know, you get back to broke pretty quickly and then start building real wealth from there. And I think that's probably the number one mistake physicians make. Rather than doing that, what they do is they've already bought the big house before they even get out of residency. They've got two expensive cars they bought on credit. And now all of a sudden they have to start making payments on their student loans, which they refinance and drag out for 20 or 25 years and really never focus on building wealth. And it's a whole lot harder to cut back your lifestyle later and start saving money than to never grow into that income all the way in the first place.
So let's do a top three. Top three, or you can plus or minus if you want to. We've got a number of listeners here that are going to be students, that are going to be residents, that are going to be attending. So let's do residents. Top three things they should be doing now based on their resident salary to establish a great foundation for tomorrow and moving forward. And then let's do the top three or so for attendings. If you aren't really in a comfortable place financially, what you need to be doing to kind of stabilize yourself moving forward and not have to work until you're 108 years old.
Sure. For residents, I think number one is get some insurance in place. I mean, the worst thing that can happen to you is you invest a decade of your life into the ability to earn an income, and then you become disabled and can't do that. So buying disability insurance relatively early in residency is pretty important for most of us, unless we've got some other way to support us, a spouse or something. That probably ought to be a huge priority. Likewise, if anybody else is depending on our ability to earn an income, you need to buy a whole bunch of term life insurance. So number one mistake for residents is not being adequately insured. The second one is not starting to save. Now, you can't make and save enough money as a resident to really make a huge financial difference in your life. But the habits you develop as a resident will carry forward as an attending. And so I think it's good to save something for retirement as a resident. Even though you have all these student loans, even though you have all these uses for your cash, I think saving something for retirement is a good idea. And that ought to be done because you're in a low tax bracket as a resident, probably the lowest you'll ever be in again for the rest of your life, including retirement. You ought to be doing it in a Roth account or a tax-free account. So if your residency offers you a residency match in a Roth 403b or a Roth 401k, I'd take advantage of that. Otherwise, I would use a Roth IRA to do that saving. And number three, probably the most important for a resident, is to develop a written financial plan so that when you become an attending, you start getting those big fat paychecks that you hit the ground running. If you literally have a written plan for what you're going to do with your first 12 paychecks as an attending, I think you're going to be very, very successful financially. Unfortunately, too many of us hit that point, don't have any plan, and end up squandering this huge opportunity we have to build wealth. And so I think those are the three things for residents. As we come into the attending years, I think you do have to readdress that insurance issue. Most of us will have to buy a little bit more disability insurance just because we either couldn't afford or they weren't willing to sell us enough as we need to really cover our expenses and our need to save for retirement. So buying a little bit more disability insurance, maybe a little more term life insurance as an attending, is important, but I don't know if it quite hits the top three. I think the top three are probably making sure you're saving enough of your income for retirement. And my usual recommendation is 20%, 20% of your gross income for retirement. And hopefully in those first few years of living like a resident, you'll be able to put even more than that toward building wealth, you know, between paying off your student loans and saving up a down payment and funding retirement accounts. Hopefully you'll be even higher than 20%. But 20% for the long run for retirement is pretty much where people need to be to get that retirement they're hoping to have. So I would put that as number one. Number two is having some sort of reasonable investing plan. And there's 100 different ways to invest that are reasonable. You just need to make sure you're picking one of them, not some crazy way to invest. You know, a lot of people are trying to time the market, or they're trying to pick a guru that's going to lead them into picking the right, you know, individual stocks, or they've got a portfolio that's 50% gold, or they've been suckered into whole life insurance, for instance, you know, with its very low returns in the first decade and low expected returns, even if you hold it for your entire lifetime. So I think you need some sort of reasonable investing plan, a reasonable mix of low cost stock and bond index funds, and maybe some real estate that you can stick with throughout your career and actually build wealth with. So if number one is saving enough money, number two is some sort of a reasonable investing plan. Number three would be watching what you're paying for financial advice. A lot of docs don't realize that financial advice is really expensive stuff. If you can learn to do it well yourself, you save all that money, and that money can really help you become financially independent literally years earlier than you otherwise would be. But even if you want to use a financial advisor, that's okay, as long as you're getting good advice at a fair price. And a fair price is usually something between $1,000 and $10,000 a year. If you're paying more than that for financial advice, or if you're not getting good advice, you need a different advisor.
The big thing that I see that you mentioned whole life, and the big thing that my wife and I got suckered into as residents was, you know, getting a big company that really says they're doing financial advising, but really their whole goal is selling policies. You know, getting into, you know, huge policies of life insurance, whole life, trying to focus on whole life, because I know it's pretty profitable for them. You mentioned, and you got into that advising. What are some of the things you need to look at, other than the cost for advising, who shouldn't be doing advising, such as companies whose main goal is insurance? And, you know, I know a lot of physicians are out there thinking, I'm a doctor, I'm really smart, I can do it better on my own. How do you know your limitations?
Well, it's a lot of complex questions there all rolled up into one. I think two of the key words you should be looking for when you're looking to hire a financial advisor are fee only. And that's different than fee-based. Fee-based means they charge you a fee and they charge you commissions. But fee-only, they basically are selling their advice, just like a physician or an attorney or an accountant sells their advice. So you want a fee-only advisor. You want somebody that's also functioning as a fiduciary. That means they will do the right thing for you, whether it's in their best interest or not. So it's a little bit like the Hippocratic Oath for physicians. You know, we wouldn't even think about doing something that was right for us, but not right for the patient. But there are plenty of people out there who call themselves financial advisors who don't feel that they are held to that same standard. And legally, they're not. So you want a fiduciary fee-only advisor. And among those fee-only advisors, they basically charge in three different ways. One is they charge an asset under management fee. So basically, this is a percentage of your assets under management. So if that percentage is 1% and they're managing $1 million for you, you'll pay them $10,000 per year. When your assets go up to $2 million, you'll pay them $20,000 per year. So that is the way an asset under management fee works. You can also pay for advice on an hourly basis. And a typical going rate for that is $200, $300, $400 an hour, something like that, to pay for advice on an hourly basis. It sounds like a lot of money. And it is, but honestly, that's probably the cheapest way to get financial advice compared to paying someone $10,000 a year to manage your portfolio. You can also pay a flat fee for the year, kind of an annual retainer to somebody, both for financial planning as well as for asset management. Those folks are a little bit less common, but they're becoming more and more common all the time. And I think that's a great way to pay for asset management, because it really doesn't take any more time or effort to manage $1 million than it does to manage $100,000. It's just, that's the nature of the asset management game. You just have to be careful to avoid advisors whose main goal is to accumulate assets so they can charge a higher percentage of the fees, rather than actually providing solid investment management and financial planning advice. So I think those are the three main categories of financial, you know, fee-only advisors that you need to watch for. But the issue is there's a whole other bunch of people out there that call themselves financial advisors who are really commissioned salesmen in disguise. They typically work for, as you mentioned, either an insurance company or a brokerage company. And they sell you products. And as they sell you products, they are paid commissions. So the problem with that approach is the worst products have to have the highest commissions in order to be sold. And so there's always this continual conflict of interest among those advisors to sell you the crummiest products, because that's how they get paid the most. And probably the best example of this is whole life insurance, because almost every physician out there will be propositioned to buy whole life insurance at some time during their career. And probably a third of doctors actually end up buying it. You know, my experience was it was sold to me as a medical student. And 7 years later, when I finally wised up and got rid of it, my overall return on that investment, and I put investment in quotation marks, was minus 33% after 7 years. I mean, I still hadn't even broken even. And as I looked at the illustrations, I wouldn't break even for another decade. I mean, it was just a terrible, terrible place to be trying to get any sort of an investment return, which is the way it was sold to me, instead of what I really needed, which was a big fat term life insurance policy. But this happens with mutual funds as well. You know, mutual fund salesmen exist out there who sell you a crummy, high expense mutual fund with a load. A load is a commission. And basically, they, you know, if they have a 6% load on the mutual fund, you give them $1,000 to invest. They take $60 and put it in their pocket, and they take your $940 and put it in the investment. So you've already started out 6% behind, which doesn't seem so crazy until you realize there are investments out there that don't charge loads at all. And so a lot of physician investors have decided to become do-it-yourselfers, which I think is a very reasonable approach. You don't have to be all or nothing. You don't have to have a full service advisor or do it all yourself. There are plenty of steps in between. But for sure, if you're going to do it yourself, you want to spend at least a little bit of time and energy learning what you're doing and figuring things out. The good news is that time spent early in your career will pay great dividends throughout your career. And, you know, and it's not that hard. You know, this stuff's way easier than, you know, trying to figure out whether a patient has a PE or not.
So if you're interested in everything that Dr. Dolly's talking about, you know, I'm following along right here on the whitecoatinvestor.com with a lot of the topics he's talking about, the seven mistakes physicians make, living like a resident, all these blog entries, they're right there. You can look them up, get more and deeper detail into those right there on his website. And it's pretty fascinating information, and it's eye-opening as somebody in healthcare, as a scientist. You think you've, as you know, once you're board certified, you've got expertise in all things living, and clearly that is not the case. Physicians make a lot of poor decisions, and a lot of things we can do well with this. And we've talked about a little bit about the loan. Okay, when I was going through, loans were subsidized. They come out at some hideously low percentage mark, but then shortly thereafter, the subsidies with these loans and medical schools went away. And my sister-in-law goes, you know, we're at 2.5%. They go to their next generation 5 years later is 6.5% and significant amount. How do you decide? And you've mentioned it here, is paying them off as quickly as possible. But much of the advice we had with the subsidized was don't pay them off because you can save more than the cost associated with them. How do you know, and where is that cutoff, and what's that best approach to loans, and some advice to those residents out there who are taking out Macs to live like kings and queens during their residency when eventually that's all going to be paid back?
Well, I mean, I think there's a few approaches to take when it comes to your student loans. But a lot of the, you know, even mid-career docs, people that came out of medical school in the early 2000s, like me, they have no idea what's going on with these younger docs. Because we came out with, maybe we had $100,000, $50,000 in loans. You know, the year I started medical school in 1999 at the University of Utah, in-state tuition was $10,000. There are a lot of medical schools in this country now with a total cost of attendance of over $100,000 per year. And the student loan burdens that people are coming out of training with reflect that. I think the average graduating from medical school is now over $200,000. But that is an average with a wide range around it. There's plenty of docs I've run into that by the time they come out of residency and these loans have compounded more and more, that are at $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 in student loans, all at $6,000 or $7,000 per year. What does that really mean? Well, that means you're paying $5,000 a month just to cover the interest on your student loans as an attendee. I mean, it's an incredible burden that's really overhanging over the heads of all of our current medical student and resident colleagues out there. And so first thing to do, I think if you're a little bit older, like I am, or even late career docs, is to realize that the game has changed. Things are very different now than they were when you went through. And so management of those student loans, doing it well from the beginning, is really important. And the first big decision point that people have with regards to their federal loans anyway, you're right that they're not subsidized. Ever since 2012, subsidized loans have gone away. So these are all unsubsidized. But as far as the federal loans, there's still potential to get those forgiven. This program is known as the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. And the way it works is that you have to make 120 payments, qualifying payments, while being employed full-time by a nonprofit, a 501c3. Now, luckily for physicians, most residency and fellowship positions are employee arrangements with a 501c3, a nonprofit employer. And so all those payments you make during residency and during fellowship count toward those 120 monthly payments. So if you did a three-year residency and a two-year fellowship, you've already got five of those 10 years of payments made. And the great thing is those payments you make as a resident and a fellow are incredibly low. They're small payments because you're in these income-driven repayment programs like IBR and pay and revised pay that allow you to make these tiny payments because they're based on your income as a resident. And so then if you come out of residency or fellowship and you make, you know, another 5 to 7 years of payments that are, you know, much larger payments because you now have a higher income, you get the rest forgiven tax-free as long as you continue to be directly employed by a 501c3 as an attending. So if you're even considering going into academics or being employed by the VA or by the military or by any other, you know, nonprofit hospital, not contracting with them, but you know, employed by them, that is the way to go for your federal loans and to get them forgiven. Yes, there's some risk that Congress could change the rules, but more than likely you'll be grandfathered in. And it's not like you can't save up some money on the side just in case the program goes away that you could then put toward your student loans. So for your federal loans, if you are considering going into academics or otherwise working for a 501c3, you need to become intimately familiar with the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. For your private loans, you might as well refinance those as a resident. There's now four companies out there refinancing loans as a resident. And the best part about it is they've kind of mirrored the federal program in that they allow you to make small payments as a resident. So not only do you get a lower interest rate, but you also can still keep those small payments. So for your private loans, refinance those as soon as you can. If you're an attending and you're not working for a 501c3, you probably ought to refinance your loans. You can usually knock 1%, 2%, or 3% off those loans if you're willing to be aggressive about paying them back. You know, taking a 5-year variable or a 5-year fixed or maybe even a 10-year loan on them, you can almost surely lower the interest rate on those loans. And everyone wonders, what's the catch? And the truth is, there's no catch. The only catch is you can't go back into the Public Service Loan Forgiveness or other federal, you know, low-income kind of programs. But most physicians just aren't going to be doing that. They're not going to qualify for that once they're an attending. So there's not a lot of risk there. If you're not going to be working for a 501c3, you might as well refinance. And the only other real complex thing about student loan management is for residents with federal loans trying to decide which of these income-driven repayment programs they should be enrolled in during residency. And if you're single or you're a single earner married to somebody else, the answer is almost always the revised pay-as-you-earn program. And the reason why is that program actually subsidizes your interest rate. So, for example, if you had $200,000 in student loans, that's at 6%, that's about $1,000 a month in interest that is accumulating on your loans. Perhaps your payment under that program would be $200 a month of that $1,000 in interest. So obviously the loan's still growing. But under the revised pay-as-you-earn program, $400 of that $1,000 of interest would just be wiped out by the federal government, and then $400 would be added onto the balance of the loan. So $1,000 of interest each month, you pay $200 of it, $400 of it's added onto the loan, and $400 is basically forgiven by the government under the revised pay-as-you-earn program. So that is the right program for those residents. If you're married to another high earner, there are some situations where you want to be in a different program, like the regular old pay program, just because if you're filing married, filing separately, it's possible you could end up getting more money for giving under that program. You know, basically, if you are married to another high earner during residency, it's worth paying a few $100 and getting some good financial advice regarding those student loans. But if you're single or if you're a single earner in a couple, the answer is basically use the repay program during residency.
I think the key here is knowing your strike zone and as a physician, not swinging outside your strike zone and knowing what your limitations are, because that's, you know, all of that stuff, that information, that data, that's not going to be in any type of program that you're in your residency or medical school. They're not going to teach you that sort of thing. So getting those resources, getting that assistance to make sure that you're on the right path. I mean, my wife and I have been with a financial advisor for quite some time, and he has been fantastic at help keeping us between the lines. And I still feel it every single day as us as physicians trying to spend down to zero, and the ways he's been able to make us a functional plan without making us completely non-functional from a home standpoint. As I mentioned, whitecoatinvestor.com, Dr. Jim Dolley, the White Coat Investor book, also a lot of resources on there, even on your page. And I know we've talked about it before. You've got some folks on the page, links to folks on your page that you've kind of, that you've vetted out to make sure that they've got some good, well-meaning intentions and products that are not just trying to fleece physicians out there. How can folks get more information from you? If they have any questions, contact via social media, whatnot.
Well, the White Coat Investor is, you know, started out as a blog, but it's really kind of a multimedia company now. And the reason why is I've discovered that everybody learns a little bit differently. So no matter how you learn, we've tried to put this information into a format that you can digest it. So there's a book, there's a blog, there's a podcast, there's a video cast or a YouTube channel. We have had live conferences. There's an online course. There's a forum. There's a Facebook group. There's a Twitter and Facebook feed. And it's all very easy to find just Googling White Coat Investor. Or you can go to whitecoatinvestor.com, and there's links to it all on the front page. But however you like to learn, we've tried to get this information to you in that format, because this is stuff that, you know, we'd all wish was taught to us in medical school and residency. But for the vast majority of us, it just wasn't. And we're going to have to pick it up on our own, doing what I call continuing financial education.
And if you're listening to this, you clearly are a fan of podcasts. And so the podcast is available on iTunes, Overcast, Stitcher, Google Play, Acast. Also, you can get the links to the actual episodes on the White Coat Investor website, with the link being the WCI-podcast, and all of them are listed there from January 2017 up until the most recent episodes as well. So, Dr. Dolley, thanks so much for joining us and for the information, incredible information. I know I learned a bunch when I was in Utah back several months ago, and hopefully our listeners have learned a ton from you today, and will be seeking out more information to make us all more financially stable and help us make correct decisions as physicians.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me on.
As for me, you can contact me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, as well as our Facebook page for ASAP Frontline, and at Everyday Med on Twitter. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.